Hi, everybody. I'm Robin Young from Here and Now and WBUR. Thank you so much for coming out to the Boston Book Festival. And let's have a big round of applause for how well it's going. I think it was just Katie barred the door just now because we are full up, and I'm not surprised. Alexander McCall Smith is here, and I'm sure how many of you have read the Isabel Dalhousie series? Okay, everybody, and are just about everybody, and we're not surprised that you've all come out for this. I want a couple of thoughts about BUR and the book festival. We're just thrilled to be partners again this year. It's such an honor to be a part of what's becoming a Boston institution. Fourth year. And it's such an honor to be a part of it. And of course, if you listen to WBUR at all, you know that the reading books by our nightstand can match yours. You know, we love to read. And so it's great to have this partnership, and we're pleased to be a part of it. And Alexander McCall Smith, I thought he was going to introduce himself to all of you, but afterwards, it would have taken a while, but afterwards we'll have a chance to line up and get a book signed, which I know many of you are looking forward to. So here we are discussing Isabel Dalhousie. And, you know, as I read, I think, how does she do it? Philosopher, editor of a philosophy journal, mother, wife, detective. But then I think we could pose the same question about her creator. Doctor, now professor emeritus of medical law at the University of Edinburgh, expert in bioethics, who served on the UNESCO International Bioethics Commission, a bassoonist with the really terrible orchestra. That's their name. I was trying to think of the name. I'm like, you know, not so good orchestra, the kind of bad orchestra. It's really the really terrible orchestra.
With the emphasis on the really, really, really terrible.
A creator of not just Isabel, but of course the glorious, precious Ramotswe of the number one ladies detective agency series.
Ah.
10 million books sold. Also the 44 Scotland Street series, the Corduroy Mansion series. Born in Zimbabwe, lives in Scotland, started an opera house in Botswana, and a project to tell all of Scottish history on a tapestry. How does he do it?
Well, I'm not making the tapestry.
Well, let me formally introduce Alexander McCall Smith.
Thank you very much indeed.
And his friends call him Sandy, and since I don't want to confuse him with the hurricane that is approaching, I will stay with Alexander. But we thank that thing. I don't know what it's going to do to us on Monday, but that warm air that we're feeling now, it's bringing. So we thank it now. So the most recent book. How many have read The Uncommon Appeal of Clouds? Oh.
It's just been published.
I get these early releases. It's so much fun because I have no idea when I'm reading what's going to happen. We will not give away.
I think it was published yesterday or the day before.
Yeah, also brand new. So you may be some of the first. And in this most recent book, a wealthy landowner in Scotland, his painting by the French realist Nicolas Poussin, am I saying that correctly?
Yes, you are. Yes, yes.
Has been stolen. So this wealthy landowner comes to Isabel for help because he's heard that she helps people fix things. And working this robbery out raises all sorts of philosophical questions, as always. Can you just tick off some?
Well, it's very interesting about art theft, that art theft is often not done in order for the thieves to be able to sell the painting, but it's really to get the ransom. It's effectively taking something and holding it for ransom, and then the insurance company ends up effectively paying. The insurance company is the one that actually loses at the end of the day. So many of these art thieves, they of course know exactly what they're after. And of course there was a very famous big art theft in Boston, wasn't there? Yes.
You had to remind us.
That was one of the that was rather sad because those paintings are still missing.
They're still
aren't
missing.
They?
The Isabella Stewart Gardner heist.
Yeah. That's a little bit unusual because I was talking, before I wrote this book, I was talking to somebody, a specialist insurer who dealt with this, and he was quite sort of laid back about it, and he said, we get them back. We will get them back. And we had a very dramatic art robbery in Scotland a few years back where Leonardo da Vinci, still in private hands, was stolen, and it was away for about 3 years, I think, a few years, And then it was found in the safe of a firm of lawyers in Glasgow, which was extraordinary. And the lawyer had been talking with one of these people who specialise in negotiating with the art thieves to get it back. And he, of course, the moment he got that painting, he really is legally required to hand it over to the police or to the owners, but he put it in the safe. So he was, he'd forgotten his basic criminal law. And he was prosecuted. He wasn't convicted. It became quite a complicated case. But it raises rather interesting issues. So they're usually not too worried. They may be worried that the painting could be damaged. That, I think, is the main thing that the thieves take it and then they put it in a cupboard or something like that, and the thing is damaged. But they usually get it back.
Well, but this is fascinating because I'm reading the book, and of course there's all sorts of other things happening throughout the book. Eddie has a girlfriend, Kat's running off doing something wild, all these characters are, and of course Isabel is raising Charlie, now 3 3/4.
Yes, something like that, yes.
Something.
She's not really going forward in real time. I mean, Charlie is getting a little bit older, but he last appeared last summer in a book about a year ago, so he hasn't really aged exactly a year, because some of my characters don't age at all. And for example, little Bertie in Scotland Street, the little boy who's got this tremendous problem with his mother. We have this very serious pushy mother problem in Scotland, in Edinburgh, and I gather that it's a sort of problem in Boston as well. I get the feeling that this is good pushy mother territory.
Well, we had healthy debates over the tiger mom or whatever
yes.
that was.
Yeah, well, Bertie's mother is pretty shocking. But poor little Bertie, he's 6, and he's been 6 for the last 8 years. and he actually wants to be 18. Because he's read that when you're 18, you can leave your mother. But the time isn't really passing for him. But little Charlie and Isabel, he's growing up a bit. Isabel's remained the same age. She's about 42, and she's been 42 for 9 years, something like that.
Me too.
And that's it's fairly common. Of course, there is this age gap between her and her now husband, Jamie. He is 14 years younger than she is. And that was a little bit dramatic, actually, because I'd originally intended that they would just be good friends, platonic. And then I came under great pressure to let Isabel have an affair with Jamie. And I was interviewed, for example, by a journalist from the London Daily Express who said to me, "You've got to let Isabel have an affair with that young man," and I was shocked by this because I said, "But these books are set in Edinburgh, and we don't go in for that sort of thing." And then I said, "And why anyway?" And she said, "Because it'd be very empowering for your lady readers over 40." And so I let it happen, and I received quite a number of letters from lady readers over 40 who said that they were indeed empowered by this development.
Well, it's not just, you know, he's younger and they have the affair, but he's lovely. He's a lovely, he adores her, he respects her. He lets her go off and meet with this man who wants to meet with the art thieves. Let's get back to the art theft, because you've plumbed this before.
Yeah.
Obviously, you love artwork. And she says it's at some point, because, and I was going to ask you, is this really how it works? A lawyer shows up representing someone who knows where the painting is but isn't the thief. Come on.
Yes.
And Isabel is, and the person is showing up for the reward.
Yes.
And Isabel asks in one of those wonderful several page long side trips she takes, what's the difference between ransom and reward?
Yes, I think there's a major difference theoretically, but in fact, in practice,
that's how it works.
Yes, there was a very interesting book on the subject written recently by the director of the National Portrait Gallery in London about the theft of the Turners from the National Gallery, which actually they went over. They were loaned to a German museum, and the thieves got in and took the Turners, and he tells a story in this book about that, and he has quite an interesting discussion because about the difference between ransom, paying ransom, and paying a fee. Mm-hmm. I must say, it's quite difficult to really keep that blue water between the two. And I think, in fact, many so-called fees paid to these middlemen are in fact paying the ransom. But you know, what's the alternative? You could say, well, okay, the thieves will then destroy the work of art, which would be such a pity. And yet, of course, as we all know, as in the old expression, the Dane geld paying the Vikings to go away. The Vikings don't go away if you pay them. I mean, if the Vikings are coming to pillage, which they did, you actually really...
It's can't stop them.
You can't negotiate. Never negotiate with Vikings.
That is another lesson. Actually, it goes off on that angle. But we also... I mean, I just love when the ethical questions come up, you being an ethicist. And, you know, who really owns art? The lawyer who comes, and again, representing someone who knows... but is not the thief. And she says, well, don't certain well-off families in Scotland represent the plunders of the past? I mean, these ethical questions you raise, you know, when should we talk to thieves? Governments don't talk to terrorists, but as the owner of the artwork says, but I really want my artwork back.
That's right, yes. So it's a lovely moral dilemma for Isabel. It's the sort of ethical issue that she likes to deal with, because she gets tied up in all sorts of extraordinary ethical questions, moral questions, in her daily life, which I suppose most of us do, because our lives are full of
them. Do we? Like her?
Well, we do. You see, for example, you go for a breakfast, a buffet breakfast, in the hotel. Are you, and this I'm sure all of us who stay in hotels, are constantly faced with this sort of issue. Do you take an extra bread roll from the buffet to eat later on? That's a very big problem. I mean, I've wrestled with this. But it is it theft? I mean, I find that really... Or are you just taking it hostage?
You know, I just want to say... Right. We were just in the hospitality room in the Boston Public Library. My bag is filled with napkin-covered little cookies and, you know, because I might starve or something. And you're right. I did think, should I take this?
Are you going to have to take this back?
Well, here are some of the things, and you know, if you read Isabel, and it's just such, she becomes a vehicle for you to, it seems, just ask all sorts of questions.
Sorry, just going back to these cookies.
Oh, yes, go, the cookies.
It's a very interesting issue. What if you've touched them? Let's say you go to the buffet and you pick something up that you don't like, but you've touched it. Do you put it back?
5-second rule.
What's that? How long is it? 5 seconds. If you've held it for 5 seconds.
For less than, you can put it back. Right?
Well, you see, many of these solutions to moral problems are arbitrary. So the 5-second rule is a very good one. Isabel has that sort of rule when she, in the first book, when Kat, her niece, has these very, very unsuitable boyfriends, including one called Toby. And Isabel can't stand Toby because of his crushed strawberry corduroy trousers and various other things. And she imagines Toby, who's a keen skier, having skiing down a mountain and being crushed by an avalanche. And she has a sort of fantasy where his legs are sticking up in their crushed strawberry corduroy out of the snow. And she rather likes this fantasy. And then she goes on to consider, if you're having a pleasant fantasy, as people, we don't, of course, but other people will have the occasional fantasy, do you let it run? Or do you say, this thought is unworthy of me, I must stop? Or do you wait 2 minutes and then say, this thought is unworthy of me? Now, your 5-second rule is too short there, I'd say.
Yes. But why do I think I'm going to see it worked into an episode? Let me just, this is from the new book. You know, her mind constantly working through these ethical questions. Okay, there's one, her nanny is teaching her young child math, and she thinks it's too early. And this spins her off on something about, I don't even know. At another point, she's talking to Eddie, and Eddie mentions something about someone that he used to know who had a medical condition that made him smell like fish. And
yes,
this sends her off on whether or not we have a Kantian duty not to offend those around us, and whether it's our duty philosophically to maintain our hygiene. And then Kant comes up again when yes. Isabel comments about a friend's sweater color. She mentions to Martha, oh, you have like an oatmeal-colored sweater. And suddenly she's ping-ponging off from Kant to Hume to yes. Voltaire and thinks, wow, how the great what the great philosophers would say about your wardrobe might be an interesting book. And this is all going on while she's supposed to be having a conversation with her friend Martha.
Yes.
Is this you? Is this how your head works?
Well, there are various answers to that question.
Yes.
The truthful one would be yes. I think most of us are like that. Most of us look about the world and we ask ourselves what if questions about the world, and we do engage in daydreams about things, and in a positively Proustian sense. You know, if you read Proust, so little happens in Proust because Proust can't get beyond the associations which crop up. So he walks to a window and suddenly he's flooded with memories of other windows. The famous example being the little Madeleine cakes. I mean, I can never look at a little tea biscuit without a Proustian moment. And
really?
Think, oh, yes.
I have no trouble not thinking of Proust.
Will you now, Robin? Yeah. You know, from henceforth, you will. And I think that we do that. And I think that's one of the great richnesses of life, that we can do that, that we see something and we associate it with something else. We're reminded of a friend who said something similar, and suddenly all sorts of memories will come back. And opening yourself up to all those associations is, I think, a very nice thing to do.
So talk to us about writing. Is this happening while you're writing? You think of, or do you have a little? For instance, she wrestles over people who want to make submissions to the magazine she edits on adoption and whether or not it's right to adopt children outside of their
yes.
ethnic group.
Yes.
Is that something you just heard of and you thought, oh, let me keep that for Isabel, or is that something that pops up while you're writing?
Well, some of these issues pop up in daily life, and I might read something in a newspaper, or somebody might say something to me about some problem or some issue, and if it has Isabel implications, I will sometimes write that down in a notebook and say that's an interesting issue. It's the sort of thing that Isabel might consider, and that's the way I work. Although when I write, these things just come to mind as I'm writing, because I think what happens when you're writing as a novelist is that you're actually getting in touch with your subconscious mind, which is the source of all fiction, in my view, a lot of fiction, in my view. I don't have to sit there and say, what's going to happen now? How should we deal with this situation? I go into a sort of dissociative state, and I'm obviously accessing my subconscious mind, and my subconscious mind is coming up with all these things, which, of course, our subconscious mind does when we dream. I think this is... our dreams are so peculiar, even if we don't remember them. Everybody has pretty peculiar dreams. I woke up night before last. I woke up and I'd been interviewing in my dream the British Prime Minister, and I was wondering whether I should call him David or Mr. Cameron. And this is for some reason this was coming. I've never met him.
So are you trying to recapture that dream state as you write?
To a certain extent, yes.
I think that's
interesting. I think that you are actually really encouraging your subconscious mind to emerge, and you're, in a sense, to use a popular description of it, you're channeling that into the onto the page. So yes, I think that you have to be receptive to the promptings of the subconscious. It's the same as saying that you need to be receptive to the imagination, or you need to be receptive to art. If you're told what is in a picture, you can appreciate it much more. You look at the picture and then you obviously get dimensions of it which you might not otherwise have got had you not had that explanation given to you. You're opening yourself to the associations, opening yourself to the ideas. And I think that's really what writing's about.
Well, and do you think, when we spoke once before on Here and Now, I asked, you know, why are you writing in the voice of women in these two very big series? And you said it was because women had more of this internal life, and men were more like, what's the football score? No, you didn't say that. You didn't say that. I just sort of said that.
I wouldn't be so rude about men.
Sorry, I mean. I didn't mean that. But you did say women have more of this internal kind of life that you illustrate through Isabel.
I think so. I think that raises very, very interesting issues. I must defend myself, and I didn't. You know, I'm not quite that dismissive of men. In fact, I wouldn't be dismissive of men at all. But I do think that there is a difference between male conversation and female conversation, and I think that it's quite a noted difference. I think many men are, unfortunately, for all sorts of reasons, principally social, but also their reasons of individual psychology, actually really inhibited from talking about what they probably would like to talk about. Now, that's no great new observation. I think this is pretty much a standard view of things, in that men probably would like to talk about their emotions more, but they can't because they've got to talk about football. And that is a great...
That external pressure.
External pressure.
Yeah.
If you go into a bar and listen to what the men are talking about, they're having quite formal conversations about the exterior world, and they're not really talking about their feelings or their emotions. Well, it depends on the bar. Some bars, you'd get a bit more of the feelings, emotions, but average bar.
Yeah. So that's one reason why you're writing in the voice of women. You have now endowed a fellowship. I think this is the first chair named after a fictional character.
Yes, it's not exactly a chair, it's a fellowship.
It is,
as far as I know, it's the only fellowship named after a fictional character. I set up the Isabel Dalhousie Fellowship in Edinburgh, at Edinburgh University. It's pretty informal. In fact, we don't have particularly sophisticated appointment procedures. I just choose the fellow, which is suits me. It's a very, very a very, very good arrangement. And we've had one so far, and the first fellow came in May, and that was the first fellow named after Isabel Dalhousie, and that was Professor Edward Mendelssohn, who's professor of English. I suspect that there'll be people in the audience who will know Edward, professor of English at Columbia. And he's the literary executive of W.H. Auden, who's my great literary enthusiasm.
Of course, and, because we see it throughout, in Isabel's as well.
Isabel quotes Auden all the time. I had a letter years ago from Edward Mendelssohn, out of the blue, this wonderful letter from Auden's executor, which obviously made me very thrilled to hear from him. And he said, I believe that W.H. Auden and Mara Motsui would have agreed on 100% of issues, which was... And there then started a correspondence between us, and he said, when next in New York could we meet for lunch, which we duly did. And he's of course, really done wonderful critical works on Auden's work. He's written the definitive treatments of Auden's work and collected all the poems. And he came over with his wife, Cheryl Mendelssohn, who's a distinguished novelist. And they were the... Edward was principally the fellow, but Cheryl was doing that as well. For a month in Edinburgh, which was very nice.
What do you hope someone who has the Isabel Dalhousie Fellowship do? What do you hope for, to come from it?
Their duties are simple and clear. They have to deliver a lecture or a talk. That's one. That's only one thing they have to do. So it's not really onerous. It's one lecture, and they've got a month or two to do it. So they can take their time, and they could deliver it in instalments if they liked. There was years ago, when the University of Oxford was being reformed, the commission looking into these arcane and highly privileged practices at the University of Oxford interviewed somebody who was called the such and such and such and such professor of Byzantine history, and this chap came before the commission and. Professor so-and-so, you are the professor of Byzantine history. I am indeed. And tell us, your duties, I believe, are to do what? I deliver a lecture. You deliver a lecture? Yes. Once a year. Once a year? Yes, but not every year.
And we wonder why the cost of college is so high. Okay. But to this fellowship, you had composer Tom Cunningham set an autumn poem to music. I'm hoping to hear that.
That was really exciting because we had Edward gave a wonderful lecture, which was very well attended, public lecture, the Isabel Dalhousie lecture, and I got two things done for that. I got a piper, to compose a tune, a bagpipe tune, in honour of Professor Mendelssohn, and it's called Professor Edward Mendelssohn's Visit to Edinburgh. And it had, the piper came in, it was a lady piper, she came in resplendent in kilt and played this wonderful piece of music. And of course that's a great tradition. If you look at Scottish pipe music, it often records particular moments. So it's a very common one would be so-and-so's visit to Edinburgh or so-and-so's visit to Glasgow or whatever, or so-and-so leaves Lough Arbour or whatever. And so that we did that. And then the second thing was that I got Tom Cunningham, a composer friend of mine, who was the composer with whom I wrote the opera, the Okavango Macbeth, the baboon opera.
How did I leave that out of the introduction?
Well,
so many things.
But he set one of Auden's poems to music, and Edward was so pleased that he's asked him to do more, and he's just finished a song cycle of six of Auden's poems set to music, and I've heard some of them that are really lovely. So that's very exciting. So good things have come from it.
Well, I look forward to hearing that. We're going to try to get a hold of that when this airs on Here and Now. But in the book, Isabel is reminded of an Auden line when she's talking to Charlie, little Charlie, about something, and it's from his poem about Freud, and the line is honest like children. She has an intense moment with her husband, Jamie, and that brings to mind another Auden line, I think from A Summer Night, when he describes this intense feeling of love.
That's right. That's a fascinating poem. Auden taught in the 30s. He taught at a school, the Down School, where they in the summer term, the senior boys took their beds out and put them in an orchard and slept under the stars, which of course is a terribly tricky thing to do in England, where it rains. And Auden decided to follow suit, and he took his bed out into the open. And apparently, he's a very eccentric character in many ways. He had a big umbrella over his bed, and he slept with this big umbrella over his bed.
Not many stars.
And the local geese came and took shelter under Auden's. And then, anyway, he had the same experience there. He sat out with colleagues in deck chairs on the lawn. And I forget the first line of the poem, under Vega I sit, or whatever it is. He sat out, and they were aware of the stars above them, and he had what he described as an extraordinary mystical experience, which he later really spoke about at some length, where he experienced agape. That great disinterested love between people. And he was at pains to point out that there was no sexual interest that any of these people had in one another. It was pure agape. And he said that the feeling of that lasted for some hours afterwards. It was just a sudden. And I think we do occasionally feel that. We suddenly sense or have a feeling of love for the other. For other people, mm-hmm. for humanity, and it's often focused on one person, but it can be generalized. And indeed, this is what one of the things that Auden really tries to do in his work is to move from that sort of particular love, even erotic love, to a greater love of humanity as being the real objective, which I think is quite interesting. I've just finished a book on Auden. I've written a book which. For Princeton University Press, called "What W.H. Auden Can Do for You," and it deals with these various poems and what they can do for you.
Well, of course you have. You know, and we thought this was a book about a painting that got stolen. I mean, this is what I love about your writing. You know, I'm suddenly thinking of all these things. I'm flashing back. There's another mention of an Auden poem, the September 1939.
Oh, yes, Robin,
everybody
yes.
was passing it around after 9/11.
Yes, so I gather, yes, yeah. yes. That's a very, very beautiful poem, although he disowned it. He said it was meretricious, and he disowned his big, famous Spain poem, but the 1st September 1939. I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street or 54th Street.
I have it here.
I sit on one of the dives. Have you
on
got
52nd
it?
Street.
I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street. It's a beautiful...
Uncertain...
And yeah, well, we mustn't read the whole poem,
no,
but isn't it lovely? I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade. Waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth, obsessing our private lives. The unmentionable odor of death offends the September night. It's just, there's one bit where
the ladies and gentlemen in the dust.
Yeah, where he talks about,
is it there? Because I dropped this, sorry.
Yes, defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies, yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. And that's that one bit about those to whom evil is done do evil in return.
Yeah, I think
it's an amazing... yes, I and the public know what all school children learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. Wow.
1939.
It's the most beautiful poem. And as you say, apparently people faxed that to one another after the attack on the Twin Towers, and they were comforted in their shock and their sorrow by those lines. So it's interesting to see how lines which Auden himself said actually he felt weren't genuine, nonetheless had this wonderful, I suppose, comforting effect.
Yes.
And so many of his poems do that. The Freud poem, there's a beautiful line there where he talks about how Freud is liberating, enables us to understand what it is that's been oppressing us. And he says, able to approach the future as a friend without a wardrobe of excuses, without a set mask of rectitude. I think lovely, able to approach the future as a friend without a wardrobe of excuses. Mm. It says it all about the liberating effect of psychoanalysis, if psychoanalysis is liberating for the individual, which it may not be, because sometimes people get stuck in psychoanalysis and they have analysis for years and they're not necessarily much further on. Other people are much helped by it. One little I'll get
Please.
Off psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
Well, just I once went to Casablanca, and which was a wonderful moment, because I arrived at this airport in Casablanca and I thought, I'm here in this iconic place. I've seen the movie. And now here I am in Casablanca. We went out from the airport and into the night, and the lights of the ancient creaky Mercedes taxi moved through the darkness, and there was a sign with a hand pointing saying, Casablanca, and I sitting in the back of the taxi humming as time goes by, as presumably all the passengers in that taxi would have done. The taxi driver would have heard that before. And then arrived. Anyway, the point about this, the next morning I went and had a little walk around, came across a bookshop, and went into the bookshop, and I couldn't work out what the books in Arabic were, but there were books in French which I was able to handle. And I saw a history of psychoanalysis in Casablanca. And so I bought this and read it. And the point about this book was by this Moroccan psychoanalyst who was bemoaning the fact that there was no history of psychoanalysis. And apparently, psychoanalysis never caught on in Morocco. But he did say, and this was a terribly poignant little fact, he said that after the war, after the fall of Vichy France, there were psychoanalysts who'd been collaborators in Vichy France, Vichy psychoanalysts. They all left, they were personae non gratae, in France, and so they went to Casablanca, and they took their patients with them, because the patients were also dependent on the psychoanalysts, that they went off and they set up a little institute of psychoanalysis next to the cycle racing track. And then the psychoanalysts died because they were getting on a bit at that stage. And they were buried. And then their patients died and were buried next to the psychoanalysts.
Oh, dear.
So you can imagine them lying there in constant analysis for the, for the rest of time. That would be a wonderful... You could write a poem. Let me be... Let me be buried next to my analyst.
By Woody Allen. I'm not sure... Yeah, okay. We want to make sure we have some time for questions. So, does everybody want you to come to their dinner party? We could go on forever. But you know what? We want to make sure we have some questions from the audience. We have time for that. I believe we have microphones set up. So you can begin coming to the microphones as I thank you, Alexander McCall-Smith, so much. There's
thank you very much.
Just so much more.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Make your way to the microphones with questions. I will say the end of the book is very, you don't find out. We think we know who stole the painting, but we don't know.
No, I'm not sure.
Nope. No, we don't know. I wondered if you knew.
No, well, not really, no.
Yeah. Okay. Go right ahead.
At the end of, I don't think all, but most of the Ma Ramotse books, you have Africa, Africa, etc., and I want to know what that means to you.
Thank you. Yes, it's a little diamond type design with Africa, 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 Africa done, just the words. I was playing with my word processor with the centering button facility, and that's how I first did that. I was seeing how it worked. And it produced this lovely little diamond motif of the word Africa, and so I left it in the script, and then it went into, and so it's in all, it was, I don't know whether it's still in the edition, but a lot of editions had it. So there's no greater significance than...
Oh, well. I mean, Voltaire was not involved in it.
I suppose what it's saying, I think it probably does say something. It's talking about the feeling for Africa that people who have lived in Africa or indeed people who visited Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, often have. I mean, I'm astonished at how many people I meet who may have read the Ma Ramotse books and then visit Botswana, for example, and come back in an important way changed. They say that. They say...
There's a tour. That you can take a tour.
You can take a Ma Ramotse tour in Kabarini. You can go and see... can go and see the sites associated with Ma Ramotse. And indeed, I think they take you to a house where they say that I lived, which I'm not entirely sure that I did.
Oh.
But I think they show you where I wrote the books, which I don't think is the case. But you can do two tours. You can do a one-day tour or a two-day tour. And I don't know what the difference is. I think the two-day tour is slower. And they probably reverse and say, "Did you see that? Let's go and take another look." But it's the feeling of the feeling that I think people who visit Africa often have. They're somehow struck by the kindness of the people, and there's a spirituality, for want of a better term, about it. You know where you'll find it beautifully expressed is in the opening pages of Karen Blixen's memoir, Out of Africa. Those first two or three pages, she talks about how she felt that she was in the place that she should be, that she wanted to be when she was standing under that East African sky. And I think that's I'm expressing a yearning and a feeling for a place, probably tinged to a great extent with nostalgia. But then I don't think there's anything wrong with nostalgia. Nostalgia gets a bad press.
I love nostalgia.
But I think we should have lots of nostalgia. And we should have nostalgia for the days when there was more nostalgia.
Well, I have
infinite regress.
A question from the second microphone. I think there are just two. Yeah.
My question's about Dream Angus.
Yes.
It's a book which is very different from most of your other books. And I read somewhere that it's supposed to be a children's book, but it didn't seem like a children's book to me.
No,
it doesn't. Where did that come from, that whole story and that style of writing?
Thank you. Thank you for that. I do like that book, Dream Angus. It's one of my less well-known books. It's not a children's book. No, it's definitely an adult book, that. It came from a request that I had from Jamie Bing, who's the publisher of in a firm called Canongate, who was doing a series of myths of the world, and he wanted a retelling of various myths. And I've always liked the myth of Dream Angus. Dream Angus is the Celtic god of love. He's a very attractive character. Many of the Celtic gods were pretty awful people. You know, they would smite you at the slightest opportunity, or play tricks on you. I mean, they're really very vindictive, the Celtic gods. And Angus was not like that at all. He was a wonderful figure, and he sort of hopped about dispensing love and affection. And he around his head were little birds that flew around his head, and the birds were his kisses. Mm-hmm. And he's a very nice young man. And this retold his story. He had a particular affection for pigs. He was very fond of pigs. And I think that's always a very good moral sign. people like pigs.
They're smart.
Well, yes, the pigs. Yes, they're very nice creatures. Mm-hmm. Pigs and dogs. Dogs are very good. We have a dog in the audience. Actually, I met the dog earlier on, who apparently is a fan of Cyril, which is the dog in the Scotland Street books.
We have another question at the first microphone.
I'd like you to say a little something about nationalism. Because you have a couple of your characters have some vague, nicely nationalistic thoughts, and it seems very charming in the mind of a Scottish or a Botswani woman. But I always wonder, what would it sound like in the mind of hordes of American men? Would it be the same?
Thank you for that. That's a very interesting question. That raises some very interesting issues. Could I say a little bit about Mara Motswe's nationalism? She says, I think in one of the books she says, I'm an African patriot, I think it's at some point. She's tremendously proud of her country. And the nationalism that she feels, and the love of country she feels, I'd be very hesitant to... I mean, nationalism has some very questionable associations to it, obviously, as you've suggested. But I think that love of country is something which is quite permissible and quite different, because love of country is love of one's fellow citizens. It's the love of those who are about you, who have been placed there by accident of just being in the same nation. And I think that it's a perfectly respectable feeling. Where it becomes questionable, obviously, is where it's directed against others, and where it becomes pride, I suppose, then it has all the flaws that pride would normally have. So I think one would be a bit suspect about that. But in Botswana, I think that I probably reasonably accurately have portrayed what the people of Botswana feel about their country. They feel really, really proud of what they've done in their country, because when Botswana got its independence in 1966 from Britain, really, I'm sorry to say, we'd done very little for the country. And it was a sort of, you know, benign neglect, more or less. And they built the whole thing up brick by brick themselves, and they're very, very proud of it. And they're proud of how they've managed in a dreadful geopolitical situation to keep this democracy, it's a functioning democracy, the rule of law has been observed, etc. And they are proud of that, and they're proud of what they've done with their diamond money, which actually has gone into building up the infrastructure, hospitals, schools, etc. It's there, you can see it. And I remember once going to what I call the orphan farm, which is in the books, which actually is a real place. It's the SOS Children's Home just outside Gaborone. And I always go and see them when I'm in Botswana. And I went along, and there's a person there who has what must be one of the most wonderful job descriptions ever. His job is father figure. He's an official father figure. Imagine the advertisement in a newspaper, wanted father figure, following term. But he's the father figure there. And I had this conversation with him, which was being filmed by the BBC. And I said to him, I asked him a question which I think in many other circumstances would seem a rather odd question to ask somebody, but in those circumstances was entirely appropriate. And I said, are you proud of your country? And he looked at me and he said, I am proud of my country. I am so proud of my country. And he wept with pride. And that was, and it was completely natural. And it's, so it's very, very strong and it's perfectly acceptable. As far as the Scottish position is concerned, there you get in Scotland, we're in a very interesting situation in Scotland because Scotland is still a nation and feels itself a nation. If you go about the streets in a Scottish city or go around Scotland and say to people, what are you? Who do you consider yourself to be? They'll say Scottish first, and then they may say British, or they may very pointedly not say British. It would vary, but just about everybody would say, well, we're Scottish. So it's a nation which has still had many of the features of nationhood, but of course entered into a political union, parliamentary union, with England in 1707, having entered into a union of the crowns back in 1603. So this is an interesting thing, and yet Scotland has survived as a separate country. It's one of those nations within a modern state in Western Europe that doesn't, you know, it has got some reservations about its position, and you find that also in Spain would be the most obvious example of that. And the thing is, sorry, I will stop in a moment. It's just it's such an interesting issue you raise that it's perfectly respectable for somebody like Angus Lordy in the 44 Scotland Street books to say, as I think he does, that he's a Scottish patriot, that he loves loves Scotland and he loves Scottish history and Scottish culture. But it's not necessarily said that's not necessarily said in any nasty way. Whereas when it's said by people who are the top dog, so to speak, and that really comes back to your comment, then it can sound different. Although at the same time, I don't think that should inhibit people in the United States, which happens to be top dog. It shouldn't inhibit people in the United States from being greatly, immensely proud of their country and saying that they're American patriots. I think you can say that. You can say that as a profound internationalist. You can say, I love my country, and I think that there are certain things which I really am very, very proud of. But at the same time, I've got I understand that other people love their countries, and that we live in an international a world which is more and more international. So, sorry, I've gone on at great length, but really, you raised such interesting issues.
I would distill that down to, it sounds different if you have a huge military and nuclear weapons. No offense to Scotland. I know that there are other, you know, groups and authors coming in. Do we have time for two more questions? We got two. Oh, fantastic. Okay. I think, sir, you were next at this. Or no, maybe. No, or no, she's next probably. At the second microphone.
Yeah. I'd just like to say how delighted I am that you've written another installment in Isabel Dalhousie series. I've been missing her so much, I've gone back to the first book and I'm working my way through it. I have a rather mundane question of a very personal nature. I grew up in Mobile, Alabama, and I grew up in Mobile, Alabama.
Oh, Mobile, yes.
And I'm just very curious about how you chose Mobile as the place from which Isabel's mother comes.
Well, thank you for that. And indeed, I'm going to Mobile on Sunday evening. I'm doing an event in Mobile on Monday because the publicists at the Random House Group know that I like Mobile. And the reason why I mentioned Mobile in the books and wrote it into Isabel's story, so to speak, is that I went there. And you can actually look at my books and you'll see references to places and indeed to people. You can work out where I've been by just looking at where. And I went to Mobile and I thought Mobile was a terribly nice place. I really liked it. And I had wonderful hosts on my first visit to Mobile. We had a wonderful party. They held a party in their house, and it was a very, very pleasant. And I decided Mobile was a very fine place. I like the oak trees, those nice oak trees. And I heard that Mobile is very, very popular with ghosts. that there are more ghosts in Mobile. That is correct, isn't it? It's a city of ghosts. Now, I think that raises all sorts of interesting issues, and I want to write a story at some stage about how the local ghosts in Mobile begin to resent these snow ghosts who come who come down from the north, you know. They come down from the ghosts, these ghosts from northern United States, go and stay in Mobile, and the local ghosts are prepared to be welcoming, but there comes a bit of a limit. And so that raises rather interesting interesting issues.
And you never know where a question is going to go with him. but we have one more, and thank you.
I'm curious about writing so many different series, and I have several questions about that. Do you write, or have you written, books from different series simultaneously? And if so, do you have difficulty moving from one voice to another? If that's not the case, what, in general, what calls you to write a book in one series as opposed to another?
Right.
And have you considered cross-pollination, having having characters from one series appear in a different series?
Well, thank you very much for that question. I do, in fact, write more than one book at a time. So at the moment, I'm writing a Scotland Street book, but I'm also writing a standalone novel and various other things. So I do have to, because I publish about four or five books a year. So therefore, that means that there's going to be an overlap. As to when I write the books, that depends on the schedule. And the schedule really depends on the contractual arrangements with the publishers and their publication dates, because they decide when things are going to be published. And then they also actually, they produce the cover and maybe write the blurb before I've written the book. And the title, we decide on titles before I've written the book. And then that involves some necessary agility on my part to try and make sure that the plot bears some vague resemblance to to the titles. As for the issue of cross-pollination, I'm often asked whether it would be possible to get characters visiting one another in the books. In particular, people want Isabel Dalhousie to meet Mara Motswe, and they also want little Bertie to meet he could meet Isabel Dalhousie or indeed Mara Motswe. And I usually decline. In fact, I always decline to do that, because I think the problem about that is that reading fiction, involves a suspension of disbelief anyway. When we're reading fiction, we say to ourselves, this is true. We feel that it is true, because the tears we cry when we read a sad passage in a novel are real tears. So we really believe that this, at one level, that this is there's truth there. And I think that if you actually had fictional characters from another book appearing out of context, then that's a sort of double request for a suspension of disbelief, so I wouldn't. Final point about actually writing two things at the same time or having this various fictional worlds and different voices is that I once got characters mixed up, and I'd written Mara Motswe Botswana manuscript, and my editor in New York, Edward Kastenmeier, said to me, oh, look at page 86 or whatever it is, and I'm sure that Mara Motswe begins to sound like Isabel Dalhousie. And indeed, he was right. I'd switched voices, and Mara Motswe was sitting in her little office there and suddenly started talking about Immanuel Kant. And of course, they're very different ladies. Isabel Dalhousie drinks New Zealand white wine, Mara Motswe drinks red bush tea, and so on. And they're different world views. But I see a sign saying 3 minutes.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Thank you very much for that question.
We do have to kind of bring it to a close. And by the way, remind me, because there's a choreography that's about to happen. Where is the line going to be for the books? Is it along this side? On that side? That side. They're all over there. So if you are going to be the first on your block to get one of these books, you will line up along here. And if you feel that you are needing to go to hear another author, you can maybe come around this side. So we'll try to gravitate that way. Alexander McCall-Smith, I just want to thank you so much. You take us so many places besides Scotland and Botswana. Thank you so much. Alexander McCall-Smith.
Thank you very much, Robin. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Hello?
Yep.